Thank you for that wonderful introduction. And you know, most places I go and they say the same sort of things, and I feel I'm pretty smart. But I have to say, when I come here, I feel all I can say about the people here is that I'm smart enough to recognize that these people are much cleverer than I am, and it's a real privilege to come and speak in front of just some of the cleverest people in the world of physics and science. And thank you very much. Some people might use the word humbled, but I'm an experimental test pilot, and you know, those of us who believe we have the right stuff, the word humbled is not in our vocabulary. But I'm flattered to be asked, and thank you. And also, I love being described as a real scientist. When I emigrated to the United States some years ago, I came in the category of people of a rather narrow group of people of outstanding achievement. And it was so nice. And I went to the embassy in London to sign the papers, and the woman looks up and she says, "Ah, natural scientist. Oh, a real E11, she says, "not another pop star." So I'm proud to be a real scientist. But I mean, I feel, you know, I mean, on the scale of what goes on here, I'm a technologist more than the scientist. I'm perhaps an applied scientist. I'm going to paint, I hope, a broad picture of ballooning. If you want to study genetics, you study fruit flies because they're so simple, and yet the lessons that you learn have some universal application. And I think that if you're interested in the scientific method, the evolution of scientific thinking, and particularly this thing, intellectual courage, courage to think the unthinkable, I think ballooning, the history of ballooning, is a wonderful microcosm of science. It started at roughly the same time. Benjamin Franklin, who might be regarded as one of the inventors of the scientific method that we call it today, Benjamin Franklin was there when the first balloon took off, and this will be a bit of a theme through my lecture tonight. And the Montgolfier brothers flew in a balloon, get this, made out of paper, heated with burning straw. It is hard to imagine a less practical way to fly. And indeed, although this, you know, here in America we think of flying as being the Wright brothers, but the French did it, damn it. More than 220 years ago, the French were the first to fly. And I feel that the Montgolfier brothers are rightly on a giant statue because more than anything, they had the intellectual courage to do the impossible. They had the intellectual courage to invade the territory of the angels. And very specifically, they didn't need any physical courage because plan A was to send up two convicts who'd been condemned to death. And Pilate de Rozier got his place in history because he said it's a great honor to be the first person to fly. He said to his friend, the Marquis d'Allende, "Please go to the king and persuade the king that I should be allowed to fly." And the king turned back to Dallande and said, "You are very convincing. Not only shall de Rozier go, but so shall you." So be careful what you try and persuade people of. Now, the Montgolfier brothers, they had the intellectual courage. They had the daring to go. And by contrast, Professor Charles didn't. I think to people in this room, if you've heard of Professor Charles at all, you've heard of Professor Charles because of Charles's laws, one of the gas laws. Hydrogen had been discovered, inflammable air, discovered 17 years before. Within minutes of the discovery of hydrogen, people started blowing soap bubbles and watching them go up to the ceiling. Within weeks or months, within a year at the most, people proposed that if you were to make a bladder big enough, lo, it could lift a man into the air. And Professor Charles was acutely aware of all this, and he didn't have the courage to try it. Professor Charles waited. He flew in this balloon literally 10 days after the Montgolfier brothers. Until somebody else had gone first, he didn't have the nerve to do it. and it's very interesting. His balloon was, they made it in 10 days, but it was not a casual invention. These two balloons, these two images, are both taken in France, and they're 220 years apart. Professor all the features that Professor Charles used in his balloon are in use today. The Montgolfier brothers, would you go up in a balloon made out of paper, heated with burning straw? Maybe 10 or 15 balloons like that were made in all history. Professor Charles's balloon, people are making them today. The appendix at the base, which is terribly important for safety, the netted balloon to carry the load, the heavy weight of the basket to carry that into the fabric, and although you can't see it, the valve at the top of the balloon. But Professor Charles lacked the courage to go, so the statue is to the Montgolfier brothers. And I like to say that, you know, I think it's not by accident that the first balloon flight happened when it did. The American Revolution had just happened. Sapere aude, the Enlightenment was in full swing. The scientific method was coming into being. The French Revolution was about to happen. You know, human thought, it's hard to imagine, but I think it's safe to say human thought was in a sort of total state of uproar. And I think that the flight of the first balloon flight is an acute symptom, not a cause in any way, but an acute symptom of the mindset, the courage, you know, to think the unthinkable. And balloons just have been used for science ever since. This is Gay-Lussac. It's interesting that the two of the three gas laws were developed by people who first went up in balloons, and then they thought, oh, hang on, we need to think about this a little bit. Oh, there's one more point I wanted to make about Ben Franklin, which is kind of important, that people really thought that the Montgolfier brothers would be struck down by from heaven, that they were in, you know, they were going into God's territory. And that seems a little far-fetched today, but at this time in history, Ben Franklin had invented the lightning rod, and the clergy were absolutely opposed to the lightning rod because they thought lightning was God's way of punishing sinners, and that if this wretched Franklin fellow was protecting sinners. So I think it's easy to laugh now, but I think it's really significant at the time. So Gay-Lussac flew to a great height in 1804, and now balloons have been used throughout history for a lot of science. Millikan, the man who won the Nobel Prize for Physics for the oil drop experiment, Millikan used balloons to investigate cosmic rays. They made the simple observation that as you went higher in the atmosphere, the rays got stronger. So they deduced, totally correctly, that cosmic rays were of cosmic origin, of origin outside the Earth. Millikan actually coined cosmic rays. And this is Professor Picard, who to me is a man of enormous intellectual courage. And to me, this is the second most important balloon flight in all history. Picard made this peculiar thing, which is a pressurized cabin, and it's not just the first pressurized cabin for a balloon, it's the first pressurized cabin for any aircraft. And in 1931, he flew to 51,000 feet, which was much, much higher than any airplane could go at the time. He made this huge balloon with a novel structure. I love this picture. He's a gentleman scientist, as we would like to find at KITP today. Here he is inside his pressurized cabin. There's the hatch closed with the induction coil to generate high voltage to run his ionizing detectors. Oh, and by the way, as a general observation, I know about balloons. And if I say things about cosmic rays or anything else which are wrong, you know, be courteous and just put the audience right when we get to questions. But if it's too awful, just shout out. And here's the gentleman scientist in his cabin, wearing a suit. You don't understand. I was brought up in England. I would have gone in a suit. There he is wearing a white shirt and tie. And I mean, it's just these little snippets which I think are so important. He went to a manufacturer who said that it was quite impossible to make this cabin. So he went to another company and said that what he wished to do was experimental fermentation of beer. That they wanted to do it under pressure. They need this pressurized sphere, and it needed windows so that they could look in and watch the fermentation process. And Picard, I like to say that, you know, meticulously thought everything through in every detail, and I, you know, he thought about it, and he had just had the intellectual courage, and I like to say that he got in, closed the hatch, and sort of metaphorically folded his arms and say, cut the ropes, and off he went. And of course it must be remembered that in the history of aviation there are hundreds of pilots who were told they would die if they take or took off, and of course they promptly took off and crashed. but I mean, Picard just a real giant. I want to talk just a little bit about airships, only because from a commercial point of view I'm substantially involved in airship work. Very simple and important distinction: giant rigid airships like the Hindenburg, with a rigid framework, these had never been successful, and I think it's hard to believe that they'll ever be successful. And rigid airships give blimps a bad name. Blimps are very, very simple. They just use a fabric structure with helium gas inside under a little pressure, and they're simple, and they have a wonderful success record. Immensely important in the Battle of the Atlantic. Convoys leaving the United States, leaving the East Coast to go to Europe, were never successfully attacked by submarines when protected by blimps. Trouble is, the blimps couldn't go the whole way across the Atlantic. Highly successful. Blimps languished somewhat up until the 1980s, and then a small British company that I was part of, we got a contract and we built this new airship, this new blimp, with an elegant composite structure, propellers that could be vectored to turn up and down, and this ship flew at the opening of the Los Angeles Olympics in 1984, and I think it's safe to say that it changed history, because people said, oh rats, if this bunch of kids from Britain can build blimps, so can we. And they all did. But I helped design this craft, and actually physically did some of the assembly myself. And airships that I helped design have flown at every Olympic Games since, including Athens 2 years ago, two and a half years ago. Everybody looks at them and thinks that they're just there to advertise, but of course the local police love them, because what are the qualities of a blimp? It's a great place to put a camera, to watch a football game. It's a wonderful place to put, it's very stable, calm, stays there for hours on end. It's a great place to put cameras to look for miscreants. And this is exactly how they were used at every Olympic Games. As I said, blimps have, you know, got a great record of success, and an idea that I think is really should be promoted is this: what you're looking at is an artist's impression for a simple but beautifully architectured blimp. And because of the unique conditions that exist in Santa Barbara and Los Angeles, what I propose is that when you arrive at Los Angeles Airport, instead of having to get on a little tiny plane and fly into Santa Barbara, or drive through Ventura in a limousine, that your holiday, your vacation would begin right there at the airport. You'd be met in the airport by white-coated stewards from some 1930s movie about ocean liners. You would climb into this blimp, and I'm quite serious about this. It's a very simple, straightforward, and practical project, and that you would fly up the coast, as you're about to see, literally listening to music played on an aluminum grand piano, and sipping cocktails. And this is the view of 101 from a blimp. It looks so tranquil. nobody cuts you off. And as you come up, they're the most wonderful views. There's 101, there's the shadow of the blimp, and look at the top of the mountains up there. And the blimp would arrive and land on the beach in front of the Coral Casino, and you'd walk across to the Biltmore. And, oh well, you like that idea.
Now,
I just want to briefly touch on the things. I'm involved in a whole bunch of commercial projects, but this is another one I think is really fascinating. When you get in your car and drive a few miles down the freeway, your cell phone stops working. And even, this is a typical of the cell phone companies, you know, Sprint, Nextel, who are advertising the power of two networks, so your phone will work anywhere. And this, they actually cover only 40% of the land. And that leaves a lot of people and a lot of space that's not, well, you know very well, your cell phone can't get a signal. And I'm on the board of a company called Space Data, and our concept is very simple. It's just to make very small, tiny balloons. They fly up to about 70,000 to 80,000 feet. And it works, we believe it's going to work really well. When you're in a populated area, there are lots of calls, it's economic to put up masts. When you're out in the countryside, these little balloons can't handle very many calls, but that's fine, there aren't very many. It's not economic to put up towers. But from 80,000 feet, a blimp can cover a balloon can cover a circle of at least 200 miles across. And this system is already in commercial, just get this straight, EPA approved, because some of these balloons come down and are not recovered, EPA approved, FCC licensed revenue service. And it's been in service in Texas for data only, for 2.5 years. In April it will have been for 3 years. And this is a totally practical system. We just got an order for $49 million for communications equipment. And this is how we envisage in a few years the coverage of the whole United States with the most. Balloons are wonderful, they're simple and they work. Everyone I encourage should go in a balloon once. I mean, you can't go anywhere and you can't get to a destination, but it's just the most beautiful. I think everyone has this vision of floating along in a pretty balloon, sipping champagne, and it's absolutely true, and you should do it once. And this is, you know, Temecula, and you get these beautiful views. You float over the top of the trees, and then you climb up high and get these distant views. And as it says in the flyer, Julian Knott's ballooning has nothing to do with that. This is the first crossing, well, to be truthful, the only crossing of the Sahara Desert by balloon. And this was, of course, we were young and adventurous, and I'd like to think I'm somewhat older, but still adventurous. But even from the earliest days, I've always been interested in the science and the development. And what we're about to do here is make a flight to 20,000 feet. In the middle of the Sahara, there's certainly nothing to hit and no air traffic problems. But this wasn't just this was a reasonably well thought through adventure. And I had written a model, a mathematical model, to predict the optimum rate to climb. And if you climb at the optimum speed, you use the minimum fuel, so a small balloon can get higher. And that was immediately followed. That worked beautifully. The mathematical models worked. And in this really, by modern standards, tiny balloon, I then set off to set my first world record of 36,000 feet. And I always like to say I would rather be thought organized than bold. You know, bold, foolhardy, there's this narrow dividing line. But I feel these things are very exciting and wonderful to do, but I'm also a great believer in the best conceivable parachutes and making sure that the oxygen hoses you choose are really good for minus 60 Celsius. Just, you know, the attention to detail is just of the utmost importance in these flights. And there I am, I told you pilots are pretty vain. I mean, I lifted up, this is at 36,000 feet. You can see I really am, because look, this is my breath. The oxygen comes in here and then it comes out of the bottom and you can see all the moisture from my breath. That's a piece of ice. 36,000 feet, not only did I lift up the visor on my helmet, I actually took my eyeglasses off. I mean, and because I've always worn spectacles all my life. And that's the view from 36,000 feet, 250 miles of clear view to the horizon. Encouraged by that, Professor Pickard built the first hot air balloon with a, excuse me, the first balloon with a pressure cabin. I built the first hot air balloon with a pressure cabin. And it's just a little nice thing. The comparable elements, Picard's cabin weighed 600 pounds. Ours was made out of carbon fiber and glass fiber and weighed about 100 pounds for the same elements. A lot of science in this. This is more mathematical modeling. This is a small model balloon being flown in a squash court. This was by far the biggest hot air balloon. It was twice as big. Look at the people. This gives you some idea of scale. This is a huge hot air balloon. If you've ever seen a regular hot air balloon burner, you will appreciate this is something completely different. Very difficult to make propane burn at 50,000 feet. And the balloon had a unique deflation system whereby it turned, because it's a very large balloon, very lightly loaded, would turn completely upside down. You see, there's the cabin. As the balloon inverts, there's the cabin. It deflates in a few seconds. And there it is on the way up. And that's me and a guy called Felix Pohl at the setting a new world altitude record for a hot air balloon. I'd like to come back. This is the Nazca Desert in Peru. And I'd like to come back to the whole theme of why people did things and just as much why they didn't do things, and intellectual courage and dreaming of doing things. This is the Nazca Desert in Peru, and it's very famous. And when you're on the ground, this is just exactly how it looks. And yet, when you go a few hundred feet up, you see these extraordinary... It's a genuine unsolved mystery, I think. And if you look, this drawing is on the top of the mesa. And there's this line here, and this is the hummingbird, which is perhaps the most famous. This is about 800 feet across. These are quite invisible from the ground. And the question arises, would you paint the Mona Lisa if you couldn't then stand back from the canvas and enjoy your work? So who saw these things? And of course, people constantly propose, it drives me nuts, that they were seen by alien visitors in spaceships, and that's who they were made for. Well, I think that is a considerable insult to human ingenuity. These were made 1,000 years ago, and it should 1,000 years ago in Europe, this is what was being made. And if anyone doubts, you know, KITP hadn't been founded, so the most brilliant minds of the time had to waste themselves building cathedrals. The European cathedrals are the most astonishing things, and yet no one claims that these required alien help. No one says there's any mystery, because it is absolutely recorded precisely how they were made. They were made by brilliant people who instructed great teams of people with chisels and simple tools to cut stone blocks. They used ropes and pulleys and donkeys to pull on the ropes to lift the stone blocks, and they created this. And one of my favorite little details, the Romans, when they were building, if they were short of labor, they just went and conquered another couple of countries and brought home more slaves. But in medieval times, productivity was an issue because they had to pay people, a wage that no one would settle for today, but people had to be paid. And the wheelbarrow came into the fore at this time as a tool for productivity. It's just a little favorite of mine. Anyway, back to the lines. So, suppose these things to be seen. A guy called Jim Woodman, he and I came up with this notion, well, the spaceship seems a bit far-fetched, so maybe they flew in hot air balloons. And now we have to say, prehistoric hot air balloons have become an urban myth. And in a way, it's kind of fun being an urban myth, but it's actually quite sad to see how ideas which are just myths can become really implanted in the conscience. And so Woodman and I, we built a balloon. So first of all, you've got to have a boat to ride in. And boats like this are depicted in the pyramids. This boat was made by on the shores of Lake Titicaca, 12,000 feet up in Bolivia. And people have made boats like this in South America, literally from prehistoric times. Nobody knows how long ago they were made. So there's no question the basket, the gondola, would have been easy enough. Then you come to the question of the actual balloon. The museums in South America are filled with woven fabric, which I think we, a lot of us, would call tapestries. They're just the most beautifully made things, and making the fabric would have been easy for them 1,000 years ago. Everything was done with ropes and poles and so on, things which would definitely have been available 1,000 years ago, heated with a fire, and it flew. Here we are in our pre-Inca crash helmets. And it flew. And this, the shape of this balloon is particularly chosen because it's astonishingly simple to make. It's just made out of straight fabric sewed into a spiral. You don't need a table. People make balloons on tables. You don't need a table. You don't need anything. You don't even need a ruler to make a balloon like this. If you have a loom, you can make this balloon. And, well, on fire, but I... And all sorts of civilizations could have made this. This could have been done probably 4,000 years ago. Could certainly have been done a couple of thousand years ago. The Vikings would have had a great job. They made wonderful sailcloth. The Vikings would have no trouble making a balloon, but it's just this intellectual leap. How do you make this intellectual leap? Well, you have to have Einstein on the payroll. And I sort of encourage people, you know, when I talk to sort of teenagers and undergraduates, I say, I want you to go home and just imagine the unimaginable, and I want you to make a time machine out of Vons plastic bags, which is kind of what this balloon is. I mean, it's just the simplest thing that could have been done, but it didn't occur, and if it did, probably people would have thought, you know, it's just, how could we? I'm going to talk now about more about science, this, and about particular work of mine. This is indeed an entirely new kind of balloon, and you'll see what this is as we go. People in recent years have... People always want to make things fly higher and further. And there's been a big focus on making larger and larger and more complicated and more expensive balloons. I wanted to do something radically simple to dramatically improve the performance of balloons. For 223 years, when the sun sets and the balloon cools, people have been dropping out sand, ballast, dead weight ballast. And of course, if you drop out a pound of sand, roughly speaking, without being too pedantic about the physics, you gain 1 pound in lift. Now, if instead of carrying sand, you were to carry cryogenic helium, liquid helium, if you take 1 pound of helium and evaporate it and flow it up into the balloon, this generates a startling 7 pounds of lift. So the potential is there to fly with the most, just with the simplest possible balloon, the potential is there to fly 7 times as long. And it's extraordinary. No one had thought of this, and I hold the most simple basic patent on this idea. And we built this craft. And this is, nobody knows about this. This is in Orange County, just by John Wayne Airport. This is a blimp hangar. It's 120 feet to the top of the doors. It's wonderful. You just inflate your balloon in the calm inside, walk out into the sunlight, and fly away. And we flew this balloon. This is leaving Orange County. That's the Santa Ana River. This is the 405 freeway. This is the curve around to Long Beach, is about here, and LAX would be somewhere here, and Santa Barbara's over there. And this worked really beautifully. Here we are, this is the Salton Sea, at high altitude, crossing over the border into Arizona at sunset, and it was a big success. We flew above 30,000 feet for 5 hours at night, and actually that's getting close to the coldest part of the atmosphere, and obviously the cold and it's difficult to get through. So this craft works beautifully. And just this now you can see what it is. These are the cryogenic helium containers. This is the pressurized cabin. This is S. Curtis Johnson, as in S.C. Johnson, a family company. This is S.C. Johnson III, and wonderful guy to fly with, a skydiver and a pilot, and just a wonderful person. And this exists, it really works beautifully. I just mentioned quickly, I said that I'd always like to be thought organized rather than brave. This is just a little central detail. What this is a high explosive cord. It's made for escape from helicopters, but we were able to adapt it directly. So if things go disastrously wrong, you know, if you're up Mount Everest and the weather changes, you're stuck. If something goes disastrously wrong in this craft, far off the window, there's a gaping hole. As long as you have the physical courage to go with your intellectual certainty that your parachute will work, you can be out in 2 or 3 seconds and on your way to safety. And of course, that's not quite enough. I'm a great believer in parachutes, and this is another thing I think is really pretty good. People usually develop new parachutes for when they develop a new fighter jet or something. We develop these parachutes, and really simply, there's a stabilizing drogue so that you can jump out at 45,000 feet, jump out, and you don't have to do anything till you get back to the surface. Entirely simple and automatic. And the truth is, when things are going wrong, we all think we're supermen, but we're not. When things go wrong quickly, it's very easy to do the wrong thing in the wrong order. And so, great attention to the cautious safety details. Just obviously, you know, balloon adventures come at a sort of range of prices. It's very striking that there's a whole lot of people out there who have already paid $200,000 to fly in space before there aren't even craft that exist, and there's a huge number of people that have put down $10,000 deposits. I think this is surprising and wonderful and very encouraging for people like me. Now, for $200,000, you get 5 minutes in space. In no time, everyone in Beverly Hills will have done it. And so who will care about flying in space anymore? Now, in balloons, there are adventures, if you like, from sort of $50,000 to $500,000. There are adventures which are genuinely developing, you know, new developments in ballooning, genuinely pushing forward science, setting world records, and doing unique things. This is the sort of thing, it's a certain mindset, but I love to do this sort of stuff. This is a long-distance flight out of Albuquerque, launching into the night, and racing along over Texas in the morning at about 40 miles an hour, 10,000 feet up. This is oxygen, where, like I said, cautious and organized. It takes a certain mindset to want to sit in a small basket and live on crushed sandwiches and cold coffee for 3 days. But, you know, people like to go ocean racing. You know, different people like different things. So there's lots of wonderful things waiting to be done in ballooning. And this particular picture, this is terribly important, not just to sport ballooning. Please pay attention in class at the back. This is very important to the whole future of scientific ballooning. Just in the last few years, it's become well enough understood to be a really practical thing to steer balloons by using the wind. And what you're looking at here, these are in meters, so up to 1,500 meters. If you fly low, you get one set of tracks, and if you fly 5,000 meters, you would get a completely different set of tracks. And by using the knowledge of this, it's just the 3 or 4 weather forecasters who really understand how to do it. And because you can't steer a balloon, you can only get in a wind that is going where you want. And wind steering has become really practical. I continue to have, I think, an unusual and wonderful career, and get to meet all sorts of extraordinary people. Prince Philip, the Queen of England. If you haven't seen the film, The Queen, you should go see it. Helen Mirren depicts the Queen with absolute accuracy. Prince Andrew, learning the details of from this slightly crazed scientist on the right, learning the details of one of my pressure cabins. Prince Charles, this is really nice, giving me the most prestigious international award of Britain's Royal Aero Club for ballooning efforts, and they haven't forgotten me. They keep asking when I'm coming home, but I have no plans. And I'm very proud of this. This is for the 100th anniversary of the Wright brothers, the Royal Air Force Museum, which is arguably the most important aviation museum in Britain, they set up a display, 100 years of aviation, Harrier jets and helicopters, and of contemporary balloons, the only one they chose to include was this balloon we're going to talk about some more, because as they saw it had interesting scientific potential. So there I am, doing my best to look respectful, waiting by my balloon. And of course the princes you've all seen, they got the job by marriage or inheritance. This is Bert Rutan, and this is Spaceship One, the craft, the first private flight into space. And you know, I feel Bert Rutan became a prince of aviation by brilliance and perseverance. And I think he's a real prince of aviation. Lots of wonderful sponsors: Rolex, Moët & Chandon, Fujitsu, Canon camera, FedEx. I love FedEx, the most efficient people in the world. FedEx transported my balloon cabin across the Atlantic, 20 feet long, as an overnight package. and I'm happy to say they did not lose it. this is one of my favorites. This is a solar-powered balloon. And of course, you know, it's not easy to get on the cover of a magazine, but people do. And I think this is something I particularly like. I think it's a really rare distinction to be on a postage stamp. And these are balloons which I designed, built, and piloted. So I feel that I may claim to be on a postage stamp. And this is Laos, but this is India, the second most populous country in the world, on the sort of the $1 stamp, the first class mail stamp. And I love that. Of course, in America, you can't be on a stamp until you've been dead for 10 years. And fortunately, that doesn't apply. We've talked about my commercial activities, my adventures, my fascination with the science, something about the history. I want to talk now about the future of the application of balloons, because I think there's some wonderful opportunities, and I hope to enthuse you all. First of all, this is the modest weather balloon. And weather balloons, these are launched from 1,200 sites around the world. They're launched every 12 hours. And, you know, who thinks about weather balloons? But if there were no weather balloons, weather forecasting as we know it wouldn't exist. And weather forecasting is central to shipping, aviation, farming. It's of enormous importance. And I think the humble weather balloon is sort of underestimated. But mostly I'm going to talk about rather more ambitious scientific balloons. I'm sure half the student body of UCSB would love to be on the cover of Rolling Stone, but here at KITP, you want to be on the cover of Nature. And this is Nature, that's good. this is a quite famous. You can look at the cosmic microwave background, you can look at that pretty well. From a balloon. I think it's little known, Arno Penzias, the old saying, one man's noise is another man's signal. And Penzias, when they had problem with their microwave towers, he thought, aha, he thought, not this is noise. He realized that the hiss that they were hearing was actually, the radiation left over from the Big Bang. And In this audience, I hesitate to say anything, but I'll say it anyway, and you can put me right later. This is an experiment carried on a balloon, and what you're looking at here, this is the microwave background. Now, this is the way I describe it. This is the main lump. That's what tells you that this is middle C. But these are the harmonics, and they tell you all sorts of other things. They tell you, as it were, whether this is middle C played on a piano or whether it's middle C played on a violin. That is as far as I shall go onto this subject. Now the COBE experiment, the Nobel Prize for physics that's just been the most recent one, was for measurements on the microwave background carried out obviously in the COBE satellite. What is less well known is that all sorts of precursor experiments, this is on the right is the COBE map of the microwave background, which I think might be described as well known in sort of scientific circles. And on the left, these are maps of the microwave background taken from balloons, and particularly Professor Lubin, who's here at UCSB, was substantially involved in this work. And Professor Lubin was the two guys got the Nobel Prize, but Professor Lubin was part of the science team for COBE. So right here in Santa Barbara. And I think this, you know, to theoretical physicists, this is just immensely important stuff. Now, everyone has a dream and ideas they wish to pass on and infuse people. Very simply, the two main sites from which scientific balloons are flown at the moment are in Antarctica and in northern Sweden. And the reason for flying from these is that they're right away from one of the reasons is that they're right away from populated areas, and therefore that there's no danger that the balloon's going to come down on the old people's home. Now, I mentioned wind steering, and I think that the whole perspective becomes changed once you figure in wind steering, and I feel that it is entirely practical and has enormous benefits that there should be a scientific balloon facility where else, but where we all live, of course, but just up the road from KITP. And people will fly experiments looking out into the universe and making extraordinary discoveries which theoretical physicists back here will turn into just greater understanding of the whole human condition, of the whole condition of the universe. And the reasons for choosing a location like out at Vandenberg, they launch rockets from there. There would be no, if you have wind steering so that you can send the balloons, be sure the balloons are going to go offshore, I see no reason why you shouldn't launch them from the Vandenberg site. They launch rockets, and there's a guy ready to push the button and blow them up in case they don't work right. So the location is here. And there's the obvious, simple, practical thing. Imagine what is involved in getting one of those huge trailers with helium, a 30-ton trailer, getting it to the Antarctic just for your helium gas, the most simple thing. Vandenberg, the biggest helium plant in the world, is in Commerce City down in Los Angeles, 150 miles. And when you forget that critical wrench or that transistor, you phone up your wife and you speak to her very lovingly and say, "Sweetheart, my princess, would you just get in your car and bring me that wrench? You'll find it in my study." When you're at the South Pole, you know, this is more difficult. But just I mean, it's obvious, no hotel bills, no transport bills, the whole thing, and those costs add up, especially flying in Antarctica, those costs add enormously. And the weather is, of course, of the utmost importance, launching balloons, and California's Central Coast has some of the best weather anywhere in the world for launching balloons. And there's one more thing, the magnetic field is shown here for a reason. If you're near the pole, all sorts of particles get in, they make the aurora. If you're fairly near the equator, where the field is roughly overhead, it screens out all sorts of high energy particles, and for certain instruments, this makes them much more practical. So there's strong reasons, and it's not in any way an impossible dream. I think it's a real thing. It's an idea whose time has come. These balloons will fly out over the Pacific, doing great science. I want to talk about one more new concept in ballooning. What you're looking at is not actually a balloon. It's an inflated hangar. You don't know what infrastructure means until you go to a place that doesn't have any. This is a balloon flight out of Western Australia, and there are no hangers big enough for balloons. Hangers, of course, make it so much easier. So I had to design this, and we built it, and it's wonderful. You don't have to wait for a forecast. When the flag hangs down, conditions are ripe to launch. The hanger, this hanger, it has the world's biggest zipper. The hanger splits open, and in a minute, you're ready to go. There's the hanger. And this balloon, I hope, is an idea whose time has come. This is looking up in the balloon. And on the left, that's my balloon, making the first crossing of Australia by balloon. And obviously this, the pumpkin concept, is an idea. I was the first person to do it, an idea that I pioneered. And it's wonderful. NASA are now developing this and for terrestrial use, and you'll see in just a minute for other uses as well. And it's very exciting to have your ideas taken up by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and people like that. And it's, I mean, JPL, they're almost as clever as KITP. I mean, it's just a fantastic group of people to be working with. I'm thrilled about it. So now we're going to show a short film which expresses, I hope, much better than I can, the importance and the interest in scientific balloons.
It's been called the quiet workhorse of space science, a means of transporting ambitious and hefty scientific experiments to the edge of space.
If I got ear plugs that wants them.
While the technology may seem old-fashioned, it remains the quickest and most cost-efficient avenue to near space.
When you compare to satellite missions that take 5 to 7 years to develop and millions of dollars, the scientific ballooning can be done on a fraction of that budget and in a fraction of that time.
But what are the challenges of launching this experiment called BLAST? A scientific payload designed to look back in time billions of years. One of the most sophisticated balloon-borne experiments ever attempted. After years of detailed design and commitment, on top of weeks of preparation in one of the world's most remote locations, success hinges on one uncontrollable factor.
The biggest enemy out here is the wind.
I think it's going to smooth out.
We sat and watched the wind blow for days.
Travel to the ends of the earth, where the passion of scientific discovery.
We need to launch within a matter of days.
And better judgment collide. Ultra-long duration balloons now in development promise significantly expanded flight durations for scientific ballooning. The ULDB design utilizes advanced materials and a new pumpkin-shaped design. The ultra-long duration balloon is also completely sealed and pressurized to better maintain altitude. More key improvements for quality of science. And in the biggest quantum leap in scientific ballooning history, NASA plans to integrate scientific balloons into deep space exploration on missions to planets like Mars.
The balloon would be packed on the rocket, launched through its multi-month journey over to Mars. It would come down through the atmosphere, be deployed, inflated, and then float over the surface of Mars, and would allow really vast coverage of the surface, where, say, rovers cover a very small area very, very well. This would allow much better look in a global sense.
From the study of the atmosphere to the origins of the universe, it's been the vehicle for some of the most significant scientific discoveries of our time. And the future holds even more promise for one of the greatest scientific stories never told.
Just the last thing that I'm going to talk about is the prospects for sending balloons to Titan. It's virtually unknown that two weather balloons, two small balloons, have already been launched into the atmosphere of Venus. You've seen that NASA are developing my pumpkin concept with the idea of sending it to Mars. And I think Titan is the little planet that gets no respect. Titan is, of course, a moon. It's vastly bigger than Pluto, which some of us still regard as being a planet. Well, that's a religious issue, we won't get into that. Titan's much larger than the Earth's moon, it's larger than Mercury, it's getting close in size to Mars. Now, Titan has various problems. It's a billion miles away. This is how it looks through a good-sized telescope. This is how it looks through the Keck telescopes with the world's most powerful telescope, 80 pixels. How much science can you do with 80 by 80 pixels? It's covered by cloud, and worst of all, it's just a moon. Who cares about moons? Well, nothing much was known. Immense speculation, but very little was known about Titan until the Cassini spacecraft arrived at Saturn 2.5 years ago. And of course, these fantastic pictures. Saturn is turning out to be the most extraordinary and fascinating. The whole system is turning out to be just fascinating. But this picture is just a few weeks old. What you're looking at, depending on your mindset, this is a boring blob or just fascinating. This is a little piece of Saturn, and this is the cloud tops of Titan. And just from orbit, what can you learn? Well, all that changed exactly 2 years ago when the Huygens probe descended. We need to just differentiate what's artist's impression and what are real pictures. This is an artist's impression of the Huygens probe descending onto the surface of Titan. And as it came out below the clouds, you know, any question that Titan was an interesting place was instantly set to rest. There were rivers, mountains, lakes and plains. And all this a billion miles away and waiting to be discovered. This is the composite map of what the Huygens probe saw on the way down. This sort of paints the picture. This is above the clouds, this is 100 miles up, this is 10 miles up, this is a mile up, and this is 1,000 feet above the surface where a balloon might float over Titan. This is an artist's impression of the Huygens probe, but the camera is here, and I want you to take careful note of that pebble with the little split in it. This is an actual photograph taken from the surface of Titan and sent back over a billion miles. And I love this picture, Neil Armstrong's footprint, which is familiar in a certain sense, although I never saw it myself. This is to the same scale, and it just gives you a feel for what you're looking at. The other thing that's so extraordinary about Titan is that of all the things in the solar system, Titan in many ways is the most like the Earth. Now that may seem a little strange. Let me explain in some detail. The Earth's atmosphere is mostly nitrogen. Titan's atmosphere is mostly nitrogen. On Earth, water evaporates into the atmosphere and falls as rain, flows into rivers, and makes lakes and seas. On Titan, exactly the same thing goes on, but it's so cold, it's not water in the atmosphere, it's liquid natural gas, liquid methane. There are only two places in the solar system where liquid rain falls on a solid surface. Santa Barbara, on Earth, and on Titan. And Titan turns out to be extraordinarily the same, and yet totally different, and just fascinating. That you're looking at, this is a radar image taken by the Cassini spacecraft. This is a radar image of Titan. And the moment that this image came back, everybody ran for their back issues of National Geographic, because this picture is of actual sand dunes in the Namibian desert. exactly parallel. I had the good fortune, by inspiration and enthusiasm, to write a paper 18 months ago. People have been talking about sending balloons to Titan for 30 years. But it was science speculation, not science fiction, but largely speculation. I wrote a paper 18 months ago that said that Titan wasn't just a place where you could fly balloons, but that by several orders of magnitude, Titan is by far the best place known in the solar system to fly balloons. We talked about all these problems about ballasting, the changes in temperature between day and night, the change in heating from the sun has been the single greatest problem in balloon design, long-duration balloons, throughout the entire history of ballooning. The second biggest problem is the ultraviolet. Any balloon that's going to fly for any length of time is going to be destroyed by the ultraviolet. In my paper, I rather cheekily wrote this sort of National Enquirer piece that said, "Mystery balloon found floating after 2,000 years." And to be a little slightly more serious, what I said was that balloons had flown over the Earth for 2 years, so there was no reason why the fabric on a balloon for Titan shouldn't last for 2,000 years. In other words, the two drivers, the two most important factors in designing balloons for the Earth just simply go away on Titan. It's a great place to design balloons. The atmospheric density is four times as big, which is very useful, but nothing like as useful as this factor of 1,000. It means the balloon is smaller. All the things to do with heat transfer is absolutely central to the design of balloons. If the gas gets hotter, you go up. If the gas gets colder, you come down. Balloon designers are constantly fretting about heat transfer. Everything to do with heat transfer on Titan is just much, much better. Gravity is down by a factor of 7, which you might think was a huge benefit, but actually the balloon stays the same size because it's the displacement, it's not the weight, it's the mass, and the mass is unchanged by the gravity. All the same, low gravity means low convection, which is helpful from the point of view of heat transfer. So as I said, a balloon has already gone to Venus. And as I said, I wrote this paper 18 months ago. As a result of writing that, I got a study contract from JPL. And it's just very exciting. I have just got a contract from JPL right here in Santa Barbara. I'm going to build a chamber to simulate the atmosphere of Titan. And we're going to fly small model balloons in it. You might ask, what's the value of small model balloons? Well, I showed these to JPL. Throughout my career, I have made small, you recognize all these from the previous balloons, I've made small, simple physical models of balloons and coupled them with large, and as complex as my brain could manage, large, complex mathematical models. And, well, that's how you get to break 79 world records, by the appliance of science. Now, this last one on the right, this is brand new. And this is something that we might well fly in this new chamber. This is right here in Santa Barbara. I love Santa Barbara. It's full of small startup companies, people full of new ideas. This is a rather new type of balloon, as you can see. It's being inflated to watch the change in volume. This is here to measure various parameters. This highly scientific 20 kilogram weight is highly sized, weighs exactly 20 kilograms. What more could you ask? Maybe it was 20 pounds. So there's this new design. And I'm just thrilled and excited to be absolutely the beginning stages. The possibility of sending balloons to fly in the atmosphere of Titan, figuratively and literally, it's a long way off. And I just want to close with a couple more pictures of Titan. I think, you know, Why bother to go and explore the planets? And I feel of all the places in the solar system worth exploring, Mars is not really in the least like Earth. Venus, with a temperature of 450 Celsius at the surface, is totally unlike Earth. And yet Titan, it has mountain building, it has volcanoes, it has rain and erosion, just like the Earth. It has rivers and lakes, what this is. To me, this is just astonishing. I mean, other people may have different views. I think to some people this just looks like Brochard tests. What this is, a radar image of lakes of liquid natural gas near the pole. And if you look at maps of Finland, the lakes in northern Finland near the pole look exactly the same. And this is a mountain range. This is about 100 miles long, and the peaks are about 5,000 feet. But of course, we're just getting a view through a gap in the curtain. And I feel that, you know, Titan is so worth exploring because it's different and yet the same. And I think it's the kind of thing that will really provide important and valuable insights into the Earth. And, you know, these images, they provide just the gap in the curtain. And with a little artistic license and a little imagination, this is the sort of thing that you might see: lakes of liquid natural gas, mountains, the volcanoes on Titan, not pouring out molten rock, but pouring out molten ice. Water comes out of the volcanoes and promptly freezes instantly and forms mountains, and methane snow. And I think it's pretty exciting myself. So that's all I have to say, and thank you.
Well, as you all know, we always have a period of questions after our lectures, and I'm sure there are many questions, like, for example, was that vegetation next to those lakes?
Oh, I did say this was to inspire you for the sort of vision you might expect. Yeah, yeah.
Anyone?
Just a clarification on that hot air balloon in South America. I'm assuming that you heated the air and then the balloon rose to a certain level and then came back down. Is that
that
the process?
I mean, the Montgolfier brothers took the fire up with them and proved that that could be done. We were of a more cautious approach. We heated the balloon over the fire and got it glowing hot, and then we took a huge quantity, literally about a ton of sand, and as the balloon went up, we threw out sand to keep flying level.
You talked about the small balloons with the relays for the cell phones.
Yes.
Balloons are subject, of course, to wind currents. How do you keep them in the place where you want them?
Well, you don't. Now, literally, a couple of $100 million has been frittered on trying to make airships, to make blimps that would fly at 50,000 feet and stay in one place. The Japanese have a program. The Japanese alone have spent $100 million on this. And for cynics in the audience, it's hard to believe how this could be, but any of you who know about fifth generation computing, the Japanese spent several billion while Bill Gates ran rings around them. Big stratospheric airships don't work. The space data approach is absolutely the opposite end, what I would call the backside of Moore's law. You think of Moore's law meaning faster and faster. Moore's law means for a given performance, cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. These balloons are so inexpensive you can afford to lose them. You launch them, a balloon typically stays in range for about 12 hours. After 11 hours, you let the next one up and the first one comes down. And of course, then you have a link to the first balloon so you can go and get it back. It's in commercial service, it can't be all wrong. Yeah.
One practical question about the blimps. How close are we to just running out of helium? It's not bound by the atmosphere, by gravity, right?
No, all practical sources of helium come from radioactive decay, which has occurred over a long period, and it accumulates anywhere where natural gas accumulates. You find it's radioactive decay, alpha particles turns into helium. There is no shortage of helium in the world, truly. We explain that at length if you wish. Afterwards, yes.
So I'm curious about your pumpkin-shaped balloon design. Is the reason that design is so different from all other balloons because it's self-contained and you're not adding gas all the time?
Yeah, it's a very simple concept. It's completely closed. So when it's heated by the sun in the morning, the gas becomes pressurized but does not expand. So at sunrise you don't lose any gas, and then at sunset you've still got all the gas, so you don't need to drop any ballast. The physics is very simple. Balloons built like that, superpressure balloons, have flown for 2 years, but balloons a couple of meters in diameter. Scaling up, the engineering problems have proved to be formidable.
Cryogenic.
Yeah, no, you're next.
Cryogenic. Wait for the microphone.
Oh. Let's take the question next. Excuse me. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. Just a quick one. Julia, I wanted to know if you've flown the latest concept that you have a balloon inside a balloon?
No, that's right now it's just a concept. That model, that's just a couple of months ago in a hangar here on the airport.
A friend of mine's an amateur balloonist in Austin, Texas, and he was looking at dual envelopes, and they've been around. The question is, are you studying those to help reduce some of the radiative loss problems? Because you can treat the fabrics with certain materials, but what is the state of dual envelope or even multi-envelope designs?
What you're referring to, of course, is specifically to hot air balloons. Because with a hot air balloon, you're losing heat all the time, therefore having a double envelope, having insulation, having shiny surface, for want of a better word, low infrared emissivity, all those things are very important for hot air balloons. That double-shelled balloon is a quite different concept with a helium balloon. I could talk for hours and hours if you want to come and ask afterwards.
That cryogenic platform that you had with that was pressurized looked very heavy. Was it deceptively light?
We had a lot of trouble persuading the FAA. The FAA, they're looking at these tanks and thinking, oh my God, these propane tanks are going to drop on downtown Los Angeles. The density of liquid helium is only 1/8. The density of water. Those containers weigh, the total weight of each one, 750 kilos, 1,500 pounds, that complete container. That whole craft weighs about 5,500 pounds, complete with crushed sandwiches and cold coffee.
What do you have in a balloon on Mars with an atmosphere 1% the pressure of Earth?
Well, my answer to that would be, this is terribly, sort of, this is not the party line, I would say it was difficult. But by no means impossible. These big stratospheric balloons that fly to 120,000 feet, that is the greatest height that has been reached by a balloon over the Earth is 51 kilometers. And if anyone's good at math, that's 170,000 feet. 170,000 feet. And the atmosphere halves, the density halves every 12,000 feet at those levels, or something of that order. So Mars is equivalent to about 103,000 feet. So it's difficult, but by no means impossible. The trouble, the big problem with Mars is the huge temperature swing between day and night, which is about 2 or 3 times worse than on Earth.
So there are lots of wind.
But wind, that's the whole notion. You want the winds to carry the balloon around. I'll shut up soon. The rovers, the two wonderful rovers, in 3 years have gone a combined 10 miles. It's slow exploration. The whole notion of a balloon is that it fits between a surface rover and an orbiting craft and fly right all over the planet at an altitude of a few thousand feet.
Well, I think seem to have exhausted all questions. So up and away. And before I make some announcements, let's thank Julian again for a very exciting. So I wanted to remind those of you. I wanted to remind you all of the next public lecture, which is
actually already scheduled, so I can tell you exactly when it's going to be, April 11th, by Robert Kirshner. The title is Einstein's Blunder Undone, The Discovery of Cosmic Acceleration. And that should be quite a talk. And you should sign up. Those of you, as you know, who are friends of the KITP, get first dibs. And I thank you, the friends, for their support of this activity and others. And I certainly invite all of you who are not yet friends, in at least official friends, to take a flyer from over here and join up. And all of you are invited to join Julian, who will answer more questions, and the rest of us for refreshments in the common room down the hall. So thank you all for great questions, as usual.